Resilient people tend to be optimistic and have positive attitudes, but they're not Pollyannish or rose-colored optimists, and that means that they actually see as much of the negative as the pessimist, but they don't dwell on the negative. And they know how to filter out irrelevant negative information.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum discussing resilience, from PTSD to Hurricane Sandy, with Drs. Stephen Southwick and Dr. Dennis Charney. I'm Shelley Carson, a lecturer and researcher at Harvard's Department of Psychology. First, let me introduce both speakers. Stephen Southwick is the Glenn H. Greenberg Professor of Psychiatry and professor in the Child Study Center at the Yale School of Medicine. He is a recognized expert on the psychological and neurobiological effects of extreme psychological trauma. And he has worked with a wide range of stress-sensitive and stress-resilient individuals, including combat veterans with PTSD and very high-functioning stress-resilient prisoners of war and active special forces soldiers. Dennis Charney is the Ann and Joel Ehrenkrantz Dean of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, a world expert in the neurobiology and treatment of mood and anxiety disorders. Dr. Charney has made fundamental contributions to our understanding of the causes of human anxiety, fear, and depression, and the discovery of new treatments for anxiety and mood disorders. Dr. Charney and Dr. Southwick have co-authored the book Resilience, The Science of Mastering Life's Greatest Challenges. Welcome to the Cambridge Forum, Stephen Southwick.
Dr. Charney and I have studied the stress response, post-traumatic stress disorder, and resilience for about 25 years. And we're very passionate about the topic of resilience because we feel that it's so important to everyday life. But what really is resilience? Resilience basically is the ability to bend but not break in the face of adversity and to continue on to grow. Now, some people are more resilient than others, and this is a very complex topic, but one that we and many other researchers have been investigating. There are genetic factors, of course. There are developmental factors, how I was raised. For example, we might ask, is it good to expose your children to stress? Yes, it is good, as long as that stress is manageable. There are thousands of studies showing that uncontrollable stress, stress that I cannot master, can be toxic to the nervous system, can have long-lasting effects. On the other hand, exposure to stress that I can master, that is controllable, can actually make me stress hardier. And with children, as children master stresses, they become stronger and stronger and better able to handle the various adversities that we all face during our life. The question is, where is that zone of being out of my comfort zone but not being overwhelmed? And I think it's a very, very complex topic. Great parents, great coaches, great mentors really come to understand their mentee, their child, well enough that they know where that zone of growth is, being out of the comfort zone but not overwhelmed. There are also, so there are genetic factors, there are developmental factors, there are a host of neurobiologic factors, and there are many what we call psychosocial factors. So Dennis and I had the great privilege of interviewing many highly resilient individuals, starting with former prisoners of war from Vietnam, and we interviewed special forces instructors because we thought, who better to teach about resilience and learning how to become resilient than special forces instructors, and men and women, civilian adults and children who had been through massive stress but were faring very well nevertheless. And we did, along with neurobiologic studies, because we mostly do neurobiological research, we also did in-depth interviews of all of these individuals. And when we went back through the transcripts, we noticed that resilient individuals tended to use the same or very similar coping mechanisms to deal with adversity. And so the book that we've written is really describing in more detail these mechanisms that the highly resilient people we interviewed told us about. And really, we try to step back and have those who we've interviewed become the instructors to the reader. Once we had gone through these in-depth interviews, we went to the psychological and social literature and the neuroscience literature and found lots of support for these 10 factors. I'd just like to briefly describe some of these factors. One is learning to face fear. If you're going to be resilient, sooner or later, you have to learn to face what you're afraid of. And it's great the Special Forces have a very organized and systematic way to do that. We all limit our lives fairly dramatically because of what we're afraid of. And if you're like me, there are lots of things in my life that I didn't do or don't do because I'm afraid of them. Well, learning to face what you're afraid of is a very important aspect of resilience. Resilient people tend to be optimistic and have positive attitudes, but they're not Pollyannish or rose-colored optimists. They're what we might call realistic optimists, and that means that they actually see as much of the negative as the pessimist, but they don't dwell on the negative. And they know how to filter out irrelevant negative information. Optimism and the feeling that things will work out, the future will be bright, is very powerful and highly associated with resilience. Resilient individuals also tend to be active copers as opposed to passive copers. So what is active coping? Well, active coping is I'm gathering information, I'm problem solving, I'm confronting when necessary, I am reaching out for social support, I'm actively doing that. What about, I may be reappraising a particular situation, I may be reappraising a negative event to see if there is some opportunity, some positive aspect to that. These are all active coping mechanisms. Negative coping mechanisms include things like denying that there's a problem altogether, and avoidance and withdrawal. Now, this is very common. We all do it. However, avoidance never or rarely works. So it turns out at the heart of all of the anxiety disorders, like panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, PTSD, avoidance is at the heart of all of these disorders. Now, some other passive coping mechanisms might be using substances as a way of avoiding. Another is to constantly vent. And I love venting. I love negative venting, but it doesn't work. Or blaming other people. I love blaming other people, but that doesn't work either. So resilient people tend to be active copers. They also tend to take care of themselves. Exercise, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk about the neuroscience of exercise, being in good physical condition, cardiovascular exercise. It's a fascinating science at this point. But the people that we interviewed, many of them found exercise to be really critical, that as I achieve these goals and as I increase my cardiovascular capacity and so forth, not only do I increase my physical resilience, but also my emotional resilience. As I said, resilient people tend to be cognitively flexible. They can see something terrible, bad, experience something, but are always looking for something positive, some way to grow in the midst of this. And there, believe me, we all know that there are events for which that's incredible challenge. And I know there are certain events I can't imagine that I could do that. But highly resilient people are often thinking and looking for ways to reframe events. I think I will end there, and I guess Dennis.
And as Steve alluded to, the way this started out for us is we started out with a blank slate and said, we're going to learn from these individuals that we defined as resilient. And over the ensuing decade or so, we ended up interviewing literally hundreds of people. But, you know, as an example, we studied individuals from inner city Washington, D.C., who were living in poverty and surrounded by crime. We studied individuals from remote areas of Pakistan who had suffered through one of the most serious earthquakes in history, where 250,000 people were killed. We interviewed and got to know women who were, unfortunately, victims of sexual and physical abuse. As Steve mentioned, we studied the POWs from Vietnam who were held for 6 to 8 years, tortured. Many of those years, they were in solitary confinement. We also got to know the Navy SEALs and the Delta Force from the Department of Defense, from the military, to understand what kind of training can lead to resilience. So broad spectrum of individuals, started out with our blank slate, and we started to listen. And what became clear from all these individuals was that there were common factors. And one is optimism. And one of the individuals that we got to know very well that taught us a lot about optimism, we profile in the book, and her name is Deborah Gruen. Deborah was born with spina bifida. That's a congenital problem of the spinal cord that can lead to small stature, difficulty with certain bodily functions, difficulty with walking. But from day one, and I witnessed this, Deborah was optimistic. Her parents were actually kind of pessimistic people, but she was optimistic. She was can-do from day one. She swam on the swim team with other children, even though she couldn't use her legs, but she competed with them. She decided early on in her life that, you know, she was going to be able to do everything everybody else was going to do. She was can-do. So that brings up, you know, that optimism is in part genetic, because she had it from day one. You can learn to be more optimistic, but there is a genetic predisposition. I want to introduce you to another individual that we profile in the book, who in many ways changed our life, and that's Jerry White. Well, Jerry White was the co-winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997. He co-founded with Ken Rutherford the Landmine Survivors Network. When he was 19 or 20 years old, he was an underclassman at Brown, and he and some of his buddies were in the Middle East, hiking and trekking, following the paths of the prophets. Unfortunately, Jerry, being a Catholic, didn't read Hebrew. There was a Hebrew sign that said, "Don't go in this area, there are landmines." And he went in and unfortunately stepped on a landmine, and it blew off his leg. There are several important things about Jerry. Here he was, 19 years old, he had his leg blown off. Now what was going to happen? And ultimately he decided he was going to change the world. His mission became, I'm going to rid the earth of landmines. And he started the Landmine Survivors Network as a young man, and has had a major impact over the ensuing years in getting rid of landmines. Now he's an Assistant Secretary of State for Conflict Resolution. We asked Jerry about his role model, and he described kind of an amazing story to us where here he was, as I mentioned, a young man in an Israeli hospital, and a Israeli soldier, you know, walked by and knew that Jerry was suffering from being really demoralized. So the soldier came up to Jerry and said, you know, which limb do you think, you know, I'm missing? And Jerry said to him, you know, you're walking fine. It doesn't seem like there's any problem. And the soldier said to him, I lost both my limbs. You know, I'm walking with prosthesis. And then the soldier said to Jerry, which limb did you lose a limb? He said, yes. And he said, did you maintain your knee? Which is important in terms of recovery from losing a leg. And Jerry said, I do have my knee. And the soldier said to him, it's like a nose cold. You're going to be fine. And when Jerry told us that story, it was like he was telling it, you know, that it had happened yesterday. But that person, who he didn't really know, became a very important role model for him and set him on the way to doing great things. Religion and spirituality can be important, not for everybody, but for, you know, many people. And one of the stories that we heard that brought that home, we interviewed two, you know, many POWs from Vietnam, and one of the POWs told us a story that about his roommate. And they were held together for many years in a very small cell. Both were tortured, became best friends for life. And one of the roommates was very religious. Faith was very important to him. He would pray every night, and he wouldn't curse. And Al, who's the POW that was telling us the story, said, you know, he seemed to get great comfort, you know, from religion. I'm not particularly religious. So he decided over the next year while they were held together that he was going to try to become more religious. So he prayed every night, and he didn't curse. And Al was a big curser. And then after a year, he said, it's not working. So he reverted back. So religion is not for everybody. But it can be very important. In fact, in two groups that we studied, it turned out to be really critical and helpful. In the project in which we studied the inner city individuals from Washington, D.C., which was primarily an African-American population, unfortunately living in poverty and surrounded by crime, we found that individuals that did best, and we studied hundreds of individuals from that area, were those that found religion very important. That it provided critical support for them and a sense of comfort. So that turned out to be very important. So the capacity of the human mind is it can be untapped. And this is an area that many of us are now researching. We have developed certain techniques to exercise the brain that might have implications for the treatment of depression and PTSD. Not traditional psychotherapy, but more focused, what we call emotional cognitive tasks that can train the brain. And may work in conjunction with medicine or independently, but it's an exciting new area of neuroscience. You know, I can go on and on about the stories in the book. I could say in summary that it changed our life. It gave us the sense that almost anything was possible, that ordinary people can do extraordinary things. It has implications for how you even raise your children. My children said, I have five children, and they said to me, I got tougher on them since I started studying resilience, and they're right. You know, if you don't challenge your children in a way, you know, that puts them out of their comfort zone, they're not going to develop a psychological toolbox to face the inevitable challenges that we all face. Thank you.
Thank you both. You're joining us at Cambridge Forum discussing resilience with Dr. Stephen Southwick and Dr. Dennis Charney. We're examining factors that allow individuals to cope with deeply traumatic events. My question to begin with is, which of the resilience factors overall do you consider to be the most important? And secondly, are there specific types of trauma that are more associated with different factors of resilience?
Actually, one of the factors that we neglected to mention is social support. And we often think of social support as sort of a fuzzy term. But social support, there's a huge literature showing the negative physical effects and emotional effects of social isolation. In fact, social isolation may be as detrimental to how long you live as our obesity or cigarette smoking. We are made to be with other people, and social connectedness is critical, we have found, for resilience. The special forces groups will tell you, if you say, you know, you do very brave things, special forces soldiers will often say, no, it's not me, it's not that I'm brave, it's my squad. It's that these individuals have my back, I have their back, I really care about them, I'll defend them to the nth degree. And if a family member has a problem, it's not at all uncommon for family members of other special forces soldiers to go and help that family member. And some told us that for the rest of their life, they are highly connected with special forces soldiers around the country, around the world. So there's a tremendous bond that takes place, but this is important for all of us. I don't think we fully recognize. After Dennis and I did all these interviews, I changed the way that I interview people who come for help. One of the first things I do now is we sit down and we draw a map of this individual's social network. Who do you talk to during the course of a month? How many people are in your network? And what about the quality of each of these relationships? How many people could you really turn to under times of stress? And there's emerging evidence that as part of this social support network, my giving is as important, if not more important, for my own personal strength as is my receiving. So a big part is, if you want to teach children how to be resilient, one of the most important skills is teaching children how to be socially competent, how to connect with others, because there are principles. But anyway, it's a long-winded way of saying, I'm not sure that you can pick one. That's one that I think a lot about. But
in defining resilience or even thinking about yourself and your own life, no one size fits all. Really, you should look at the factors that we and other researchers have developed, and you'll see which ones kind of fit you, which your skill set is most amenable to helping you get through tough times. You raised the question of whether certain types of factors that might relate to a specific trauma. You know, I think that's in general not true, that you can utilize kind of all these factors to get through trauma, but I would mention one that Steve alluded to, and that is what we call cognitive reappraisal. And that is, once you're traumatized, you know, it's generally not your fault, but you do need to assimilate that trauma into your life view and who you are and grow from it. You know, failure is an opportunity for growth, and getting through a trauma is an opportunity for growth. And cognitive reappraisal, I think, is very important for men and women who've been abused sexually or physically. Because many times, particularly in young people, they start feeling guilty that it was somehow their fault, and it's not. And so they need to assimilate the trauma that it was not their fault, it wasn't about them, that they're gonna get through it and then they can grow from it, and that it shouldn't inhibit their life. So I think in that kind of trauma, cognitive reappraisal and moving on is very important.
At this point in the program, we're going to open questions up to those of you in the audience.
I had a question about what seems to me to be a certain moral ambiguity about the issue of resilience. On the one hand, you mentioned someone like Nelson Mandela, who uses resilience to resist oppression. On the other hand, you refer to resilience as a kind of mechanism used by special forces, who might be, for instance, on an assassination mission and would use their resilience to accomplish that task. So I have a question about what seems to me to be an unanchored quality of morality to resilience.
You know, when we were studying the special forces, we tended not to get into the moral questions of what aspects of their job was. Although I should say that we wanted to learn more about how they faced fear, how they trained for adversity. We also learned from them that a lot of what they do also involves humanitarian missions, that there are many problems around the world that our special forces are called in to help in a very positive humanitarian way.
I was wondering if you could comment on the genetic percentage in terms of, in the media we think it's 90% of cancer, but research shows it's 3%. Could you touch on that for us?
Yeah, there's been an emerging series of studies on what is the genetics of resilience. Several genes have been identified as contributing, and I'll give you one example. The serotonin transporter gene is a gene that is involved in serotonin function in the human brain. It's a gene that is involved in how antidepressant drugs work, and there are different forms of the serotonin transporter gene. One form has been found to increase vulnerability to stress. And the work in thousands of individuals found that if you were abused as a child, which is a risk factor for depression, and you had a certain form of that gene, it increased your risk further for getting depression. On the other hand, another form of that same gene, the serotonin transporter gene, was protective. So if you had that form and you had been a victim of child abuse, your risk of depression was no greater than if you had never been abused at all. So it's a protective gene. Other genes are now being identified that relate to risk on one hand and vulnerability and invulnerability on the other. More recently, there was a twin study that looked at overall the rough percentage of genetic contribution to resilience, and it was found to be moderately genetic, on the order of the genetics of certain anxiety disorders. So, and intuitively, that's kind of been our experience that, and I think if you think of people you've met in your own life, that there are some people that just seem to be born like optimistic and positive, and others, you know, seem to have an increased risk. They're more pessimistic and, you know, look at the dark side. But genes are not destiny, you know, and that's another message that was brought home to us in this area of research, that you could have a genetic risk, but you can work on it, and you can become resilient.
We talk about resilience, and you mentioned one of the important factors in strong resilience is the social network. And I look at U.S. society, and maybe it's worldwide, we spend more and more time in front of the television screen or in front of working on the computer, and much of our contact is electronic. It's not face-to-face. Now, does all of this mean that the social network is smaller and less intimate or not?
You know, it's a great question. I'm not a social media person myself, although I do very strongly believe that nurturing and maintaining and generating a social network, no matter how you do that, is critical. And what's really important is that whether it's, I don't know if you can do this through social network, I imagine, but what's really important is, are there people in your life that will help you no matter what, and who you will help no matter what? Do you have that kind of confidence and trust? I remember going into the intensive care unit as an intern, and if I was by myself, because, you know, you're just learning, I was really afraid. If I was with even one of my colleagues, I was feeling calmer. But it's a great question. I don't know if you have...
I think the expansion of the digital social network is a double-edged sword. You know, on one hand, it's had some real positive effects in connecting people for certain advocacy groups, bringing people together who have similar problems, and sharing on the network strategies to help deal with physical illness, mental illness, and so forth. So that's very positive. On the other hand, you know, my concern is that it can atrophy some real social skills in talking to people as opposed to texting people. You know, I have found that some individuals are more likely to respond to a text rather than returning my phone call. So you want to maintain the skills of face-to-face, sharing important things face-to-face, seeing the expressions on another individual. And I'm concerned, particularly, you know, with a lot of young people primarily using the digital form of communication as opposed to face-to-face, that could be a problem down the line.
Thank you, Dr. Charney, and thank you, Dr. Southwick. You have been listening to a program of the Cambridge Forum. For a CD of this forum entitled Resilience, or for additional information about our ongoing radio series, visit us on the web at cambridgeforum.org. Thank you for joining us.